Drew from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Okay, we'll keep our fingers crossed on the technology here, Leslie. But getting back to the Avalanche world, imagine the scene a couple days ago. You're at the top of the ridgeline. You have 30 years experience in the backcountry, and you know that the structure is suspect. You find lower angle terrain. You ski down about 250 to 300 feet down the slope, pull off to the left. The second person starts skiing down. They ski right next to your tracks. And by the time the smoke has cleared, a 1 to 3 foot deep avalanche, 300 feet wide, comes roaring down next to the first person and misses them narrowly by just 10 feet. These old, weak layers that we've had and we've suffered with since essentially the beginning of time have really been stressed by the, I'd say, 10 to 20 inches of storm snow and the strong prefrontal winds, and they're just at the bounds waiting for triggers out there. And these dangers are going to be where people can be skiing 10 or 11 laps, and then maybe on the 12th lap or the sixth skier on the slope. I mean, these are notoriously unreliable and unpredictable. And so most experienced people are sticking to very low angled slopes on the northwest through northeast facing slopes. It warrants still areas of considerable danger for human triggered avalanches out there. And again, cautious decision making, cautious route finding is going to be required probably over the next several days. So again, overall areas of considerable localized moderate danger for wind slabs and the steep wind loaded terrain. I'd encourage people to go online. You're going to see an accident report for the Toots to Boot avalanche over there on the Mill Creek ridgeline from a couple of days ago.
Okay. Hey, Drew, thank you. Well, joining me now in the studio with a monthly update from the Park City Board of Realtors, I have the president of the board, Todd Anderson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's just get a quick update on the stats. How's the first quarter shaping up?
So far, and obviously we're still dealing with a limited number, a small sample size, but looking at it compared to last year, we're kind of on track and tracking fairly even with last year. Down a little bit in condominium sales in town, but again, kind of hard to tell with this small of a sample size at this point.
Yeah. In terms of how busy you guys are during this time of year, I mean, is that when people are coming out to check product, the snow?
We get a lot of people out checking product, kind of seeing things, getting ideas, and oftentimes a low snow year can lead to better sales. People take that day off of skiing if they don't think it's that great, although most of our clients love the sunny days we've been having. But it will get more people looking. But in general, the first quarter tends to be the slowest of the year in terms of sales.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about low inventory. That's something we have heard over and over. Is this really just a short-lived issue, though?
No, it's really not. As we look back and look at our stats on a quarterly basis, right now this low inventory that we've been talking about can go back about 4 years right now. So it's not something that it may be the new normal.
Yeah, so. But when we see all of the development that's happened along in Wasatch County especially, maybe not so much in Park City, I mean, hasn't that added just a ton of new stuff?
It's definitely added inventory, but it's not the same as your in-town inventory. It's not as much of your ski inventory. It still tends to be a little less resort-oriented, although we're seeing some change in that right now as it does go a little more resort and second home ownership in a lot of the Wasatch County areas.
Right. Now let's talk a little bit about that. We've got, of course, Mayflower coming on. You and I both sat through a little presentation yesterday, a high-end real estate developer company owned by one man. I mean, how is a project like this going to affect the real estate project market?
You know, that's a product we've had our eyes on for quite a few years, really, waiting for it to happen and come along. And I think the timing's probably right at this point. It will add a lot of, as we both heard yesterday, a lot of luxury, you know, ski in, ski out inventory, which as we look at what's going on right now and we look out at the Canyons base area at Park City, you know, we see the lift building sold out before it's ever really broken ground. We see another product coming in that will be released in a couple of weeks here. And we've seen some very good sales up at One Empire in the Deer Valley area. So I think that we're showing that we can absorb this. And I'm sure that's what the owners at Extel are looking at when they decide to move forward with things.
Right. Three hotels we had heard, one kind of a family, still a four-star, a second five-star luxury property. They were talking maybe Four Seasons, something like that. And then the third one would be the Maida and a real big conference facility. So, I mean, does that really even impact the real estate market, hotel rooms?
You know, the vast majority of what we see out there done in hotel rooms in the past 20 years have been condominiumized hotels. So while it has the hotel moniker on it, it tends to really be owned in individual units and put back into and used as a spot that people can come to, but it's a hotel when they're not using it. So it, I think we'll probably see that type of model stuck within this.
Well, especially like what we saw at Montage in St. Regis, some of the upper floors are really, I mean, they're homes.
Yeah, absolutely. And they indicated that would be something similar to that. Now, whether or not you have something like the Montage where you have a hotel operator that owns the hotel rooms or more toward that St. Regis where everything is individually owned, that'll get to be seen and may vary according to those different programs and the different hotels they put up.
Yeah. So when brokers start looking at, or your real estate companies start working with Extel Development Company, I mean, do they have their own sales force or do they then start negotiating with real estate companies?
It's a yes and no. Some will bring in their own in-house sales. Others will use one of our local companies, and then they will all bring the rest of the real estate market to them. So, you know, they'll be in the board offices, they'll be at the different brokerages pitching what the product is and making us all aware of what it is.
Right. And then when we talk about low inventory, of course, we've got Silver Creek Village, which is, I mean, they're in infrastructure stages, but we're talking like 1,300 units here. That's a lot of real estate.
There is still a lot out there on the market, and I think as you look at Wasatch County, you'll see big numbers on there too. I kind of backed up and looked at the, after being at the Chamber's Economic Summit, and looked at the Governor's Report and looked into what they are forecasting for population growth. And with Summit County only seeing an 80% increase in the next 50 years, but watching Wasatch County see 186% increase. So they're looking at it on a state level and saying, yeah, this is what we see and what we're forecasting, and that will take up a lot of those numbers.
Yeah. We also have, of course, we'll be talking to him right after I talk to you with the acquisition of Touhey, the Talisker Club, the Empire Pass condominium site. So there's still a lot of development out there. Again, so I mean, I think I'm coming back to this notion of low inventory. It doesn't sound like it's going to stay low for long.
And maybe not. And, you know, like I said, we have seen an appetite for it, and we've seen a lot of things selling during construction. And, you know, that doesn't add to our inventory numbers as far as the way we look at them in the for sale inventory because they're pre-sold before they ever hit the market. Some before even being platted, they're under contract. So they don't necessarily add to our initial inventory as we look at it and say what's currently for sale because we don't get a lot of those until they've got their certificate of occupancy and are ready to go. That's when they hit the market. And by that point, what we're just seeing is closings instead.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the creeping interest rates. We have talked about it. Really won't have a big impact here with, what, more than half of all Park City sales being cash sales anyway?
Yeah, exactly. We still see about half of our sales is being cash purchases. And it will have an impact on the, you know, on your local buyer and the, and maybe that buyer who is financing. As we look at things, say, you know, a 1% raise in interest rates goes to, changes your buying power by about 10%. So it will have impacts. I wouldn't expect it to be immediate, though. I think that'll be a slow process in readjusting for some of that along the way.
Okay. And then really, I mean, the folks that get hit hard are those who may be looking at some of the affordable or attainable housing, like in Silver Creek Village or something, huh?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, the people that are more likely to be financing it. And like I said, that could have an impact of about 10% in their buying power along the way. So it will definitely have some impacts.
Yeah. Have we seen any more Bitcoin sales purchases?
You know, there's a lot of up and down in that right now. Mm-hmm. And it's quite volatile. I've seen some things, looking at it nationwide and still seeing some sales, but not much that we've heard of here.
Okay. Also want to just touch on homeowner association fees. And this is just a conversation that Park City Municipal has had with some of its affordable housing coming online, the need for those fees to really stay low so that it's affordable. At many places, these fees are really expensive. I mean, when you talk about an additional $600-$700 a month, I mean, that's for some, you know, half the mortgage.
Yeah, again, a huge impact. And I think as you were to look at that and break it down, every $100 equates to about $20,000 price point. So if you didn't have that $100 going toward an HOA, you could afford $20,000 more in purchase price. So it definitely has an impact. I think a lot of things when we look at HOAs gets a little hidden. Oftentimes when we see those big numbers, the cable's included, your water's included. There are a lot of inclusions in there that you really have to back out and say, this is something I'd be paying anyhow. And then the other end of that is that you're usually putting money aside for repairs in the future, for roofs, for painting, things that don't tend to happen in your single family home or your spots without a homeowners association. And so, you know, there aren't many HOAs out there that are running away and stockpiling a bunch of money. They're watched very carefully, and that money is going someplace that's designed to improve and keep the value of the property.
All right. So if a single-family homeowner were to pay more attention, they would see probably about that much anyway.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Okay. Anything else you wanted to add?
No. We're plugging along and just remind everyone to use a member of the Park City Board of Realtors.
All right, Todd. Hey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's Todd Anderson, the president of the Park City Board of Realtors. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:31. Good morning. Story Development Company, with development projects from Texas to Tennessee, has acquired its first Utah properties, Tuhe, the Wasatch County Golf Course and Home Development, as well as the Talisker Club and several residential condominium sites in Empire Pass here in Park City for an undisclosed amount. Joining me now on the phone, I have Mark Enderle. He is one of the partners in Story Development. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks so much. So begin just by telling us a little about Story. It's just you and what, one other partner or several others?
Well, there's two partners, Mark Jarber and myself. We've been partners in other ventures for years, almost exclusively in the second home environment. We joined up again here to do the Talisker acquisition because of our experience in this section of the real estate market. I've done projects for years from the Bahamas to Hawaii in both the developer and in a sales and marketing role. So this is Story was created to do the Talisker Club. It will probably do other projects in the future. But it's great to be back together with Mark working on something as exciting as Talisker, and we certainly love the opportunity to be in Park City.
Yeah, so why were you particularly interested in these properties?
Well, I don't count myself as a genius, and it doesn't take one to understand the value of what ski-in and ski-out property and Empire Pass and golf community residential properties 5 minutes from Park City, what the value of those could be. And really the promise of Talisker has always been just outstanding. And it obviously, with the financial crisis and other issues, it struggled for the last decade. But that doesn't mean the concept isn't a great one. And the good news is that we have great partners with the financial capabilities to deliver on the promises of Talisker. So it's really exciting to be at the helm of something as just outstanding conceptually as Talisker is. And you know, we just got to go block and tackle now for the next 8 or 10 years, and it should be a beautiful place and a wonderful experience.
Yeah, as you mentioned, these properties, they were foreclosed on after Talisker had failed to make payment. They were owned by Redis, a subsidiary of Wells Fargo Bank, the same company that sold Bonanza Flat to Park City. So were these properties available separately, or was it a package deal?
Well, we bought it as a package. I think Redis marketed them to the second home marketplace and entertained options from people to make offers on the individual parcels. I think the bank was particularly interested. They worked hard during the bankruptcy to keep the assets together and to keep the Talisker Club an operating entity. So I think they had a real determination to try to deliver the lifestyle that was originally Talisker. So they reached out to us and said, would you guys be interested in buying the whole thing? And we engaged with that process, and we worked out a deal that works for everybody. And I think the most important thing is that hopefully the members and the residents of these communities will be happy about what it is we've done.
Yeah, you talked about the promises of Talisker. So was that why it was important, do you think, to keep these together?
I think it was critical. If you break up the various pieces of real estate and you sell them off individually, it's very difficult for anybody to embrace the Talisker Club and all the promises of that lifestyle without having those real estate assets in place to support the cost and provide the members and the continuity of the club. So it was, I think it was critical for the continuation of Talisker, the successful continuation of Talisker, that there be a single owner of the club and for the most part an owner of the remaining real estate assets.
So all of these properties then have kind of access to the Tower Club as well as like the Touhey Golf Course. Is that how it works?
Yes, that's exactly right. Basically, there's a Talisker Club, and under the Talisker Club moniker, there are two campuses. There's the Empire Pass campus, which includes the Tower Club and the amenities around the Tower Club, and then there's the Touhey campus with the golf course and spa and fitness and a variety of other things that are yet to be built.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that Redis reached out to you, and you had told me yesterday that it was probably as a result because you were one of those that had originally bid on Bonanza Flat, which they also had at the time owned.
Our partners and I have been trying to buy the Talisker assets for the last 5 years, back when the previous developer still owned it and prior to the bankruptcy. So we've targeted this as one of the great places in America for resort second home living for years. And so you're right. There was definitely the seller knew that there was an inherent interest by us and our partners.
And then back to the Bonanza Flat, you guys made a bid, but what, got outbid?
Yeah, we lost that particular beauty pageant to somebody else, and when the winner of that contest couldn't perform, I think the bank rightfully decided that, and along with it, I guess with the interest by the city, that that Bonanza Flats belong to everybody and not just to a few. And you know, I think that's a great decision. If it's disappointing, we would have loved to have owned it, but it's going to turn out to be great for everybody.
So the fact that you've been looking at this property for the last 4 or 5 years, I mean, does the sale of Deer Valley to KSL and the Crown Partnership do change this at all?
You know, it didn't. We weren't concerned when Deer Valley was a standalone operation. You know, those guys do a fabulous job and have for years. And perhaps the purchase by KSL or the combination of Deer Valley and KSL and the Crown family makes a big positive influence. It certainly didn't hurt us in our underwriting that had happened. But Deer Valley's been a premier ski property for years. I don't think it was anything that caused this concern under any set of circumstances that it was a standalone operation. We were excited about being in and amongst Deer Valley and Park City well before that transaction.
So you've got an operating golf course. You've got two clubhouses. How much development is left to do between the properties that you've acquired?
Well, I think there's a need for additional club facilities to support the members on the mountain. There really needs to be some just an update of the outdoor recreation facilities at the Tower Club. There needs to be perhaps a full-service spa associated with the Tower Club. There's some outdoor activities on the mountain that I think we can enhance for all the residents of Empire Pass. And then out at Toohey, you know, right now it's a golf course with a spa and fitness. We really need more family amenities. We need to reach out to the kids and the millennials and provide amenities that really allow the family to gather and so it's just kind of trying to round out the amenity offering at Toohey.
Yeah, and you've got what, 500 lots there with what, just about 50 of those built on?
You know, I think there's a few more than 50 built on. There's about 250 sold, and that leaves us with, you know, somewhere between 450 and 500 lots left. That's really a function of kind of what the market tells us as we go forward. We can build up to 900 units at Toohey. We probably won't, but we could.
All right. And then how much development is there left to build up in Empire Pass?
Well, we bought, we can build some condos at the Tower Club, some residences at the Tower Club. We've got another condo site up adjacent to One Empire. And we have a parcel of land called the Marsac Horseshoe, which allows for 15 or so duplex units. We may not do duplexes, but that's what we acquired. And then there's one other parcel that the bank still owns called B2 East, which is up by Montage. And we're going to work with them and whoever wants to acquire that property to see if we can roll them into the Talisker Club as well.
Yeah. Now, do you act as your own development company, or is this you hire this out to do that?
Yeah, we're chief cook and bottle washer. We do it all. So we will work very closely with the local real estate community, the local brokerage community, to sell the property. But we basically hire people internally to manage the process. Now, obviously, we'll hire general contractors to build tall buildings and landscape architects to help us do the landscape. And, you know, we'll have a bevy of professionals help us. But we're generally where the buck stops here.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, Mark, hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Well, thanks for having me. And I look forward to seeing you sometime around Park City.
Okay. That's Mark Enderle. He is a partner in the Storied Development Company, who has just acquired Toohey, Talisker Club, and several residential condominium sites in Empire Pass. Joining me now on the phone from Pyeongchang South Korea, Tom Kelly with U.S. Ski and Snowboard. Good morning, Tom.
Well, good morning, Leslie. And I've seen photos of the snow. Is it real?
Yeah. Yeah, finally, huh? So you are actually, we're talking to you by cell phone. You're at the Austria House. What's going on there?
Yeah, I'm outside of Austria House. USA House closed at 11 o'clock, and everybody decided to head over and continue the celebration of 10 of FAA's medals. A great medal day for Team USA, Lindsey Vonn picking up the bronze in the women's downhill event, and just a few hours ago, a history being made at the Alpensia Cross Country Center in the team sprint when Keegan Randall and Jesse Biggins not only won the first women's Olympic medal ever, but they won the gold. Amazing race. Been quite a medals day.
Well, let's talk real quickly about Lindsey. I don't know if you happen to see her interview. I mean, very emotional about her final Olympic downhill competition. I think it kind of hit her hard when that reality set in.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And while I didn't see the interview, I was standing next to her at the time. So I got her side of it. And I have to tell you, the entire NBC crew and all of us standing around her had tears in our eyes as we listened to her tell her story. And I think what my takeaway from it was, while I think a lot of us as fans and supporters of hers were really looking for that gold medal, and I think with some a bit of disappointment when she got the bronze, what we really learned from listening to her words was how important that Olympic medal was, be it bronze, silver, or gold. And I talked to the NBC reporter who did the interview right after that, and she was actually even wiping away a tear, and she said, you know, when you talk to a bronze medalist, if it's someone who had totally not expected to get a medal, it's a joyous interview when they get that bronze medal. But normally, if it's someone who was going for a gold and they end up with a bronze, it's always a challenging interview. And she said this was completely different. It transcended that. And you know, I think we all took away something very special from those words that Lindsey said in a very emotional interview with NBC today.
So this isn't the end of it. I mean, does she plan to be on the World Cup tour next year to try and continue her quest of breaking the World Cup win record?
Or is this... she certainly does. In fact, it was interesting today, and I say today because we're still on a Wednesday here in Pyeongchang, but it was, she qualified when asked if this was her last Olympic race or what it would take to come back in 4 years. She tended to qualify the statement and kind of leaving the door open a little bit that she might stick around, but then at the same time talking about she didn't know if her body would really let her do that. But for certain, she's going to stick around. She wants that Stenmark record. She needs 5 more wins to tie that, and she wants to race the men. So I am sure we will see Lindsey Vonn racing next year on the World Cup Tour, and maybe we'll see her beyond that. But I know that next year is a given. Her Olympics are not finished. She will be in the Alpine Combined. That's coming up on Thursday. She, you know, in her words, she said it would be like pulling a rabbit out of the hat if she did well, but maybe she will. So she's going to be in there in the fight. Michaela Schifrin gave up today's downhill and passed on it when they had the schedule change that brought the combined race to Thursday. She will be the gold medal favorite in the Alpine Combined, the downhill taking place actually in about 11 hours from now, 10 or 11 hours from now, and then the slalom in the afternoon, and that's down at the Zhongxiang Alpine Center, home of the downhill and all of the combined events.
Okay, well, let's get back to that cross-country gold medal again. The first time ever, and I think it's been some 40-plus years since Team USA has even medaled in a cross-country event.
Yeah, only one medal, and that came in 1976. Bill Koch winning the silver medal in the 30K at Seyfeld, part of the Innsbruck Olympic Winter Games. You know, one of the things we learned tonight from Jesse Biggins, and to me this became evident in her second of three legs on this team sprint relay, was she was starting to use tactics in that second leg that were not typical of an athlete going for a medal. It was typical of an athlete going for a victory. And I don't think any of us really thought so much about that. We thought about, wouldn't it be great for us to get a medal? I don't think many people thought about getting the win, but Jesse Biggins and Keegan Randall did, and they came to the stadium tonight to win that medal. What we saw from both of them, the veteran Keegan Randall, who really ignited this sport back in the mid-2000s. And Jesse Diggins, more the newcomer, the new kid on the block, and to have the two of them paired together, this is the same duo that won the world championship in this event back in 2013. They kind of flipped the roles. What a great performance tonight by both of them.
Let's talk real quick about women's halfpipe. That on Tuesday, Maddie Bowman, who was the heir apparent here to win, had really three disappointing runs.
Yeah, it was really tough, and you know, we felt sorry for Maddie, and she had a great run, but she just kept running out of halfpipe each time. Each run down, same mistake, same trick, last trick in the halfpipe, and she just didn't have enough halfpipe left, and kept getting in the back seat a little bit and sitting down on landing. And it was tough because it was an extremely difficult run technically. She didn't maybe have the amplitude that some of the others did, in particular the Canadian gold medalist just launching out of the pipe. Britta Sigourney picking up the bronze medal also, you know, really with strong amplitude. Maddie didn't have that, but she had a lot of good technicality. But in three tries, she just could never land that last hit. And you know, felt sorry for her that she couldn't defend the medal, but, you know, I have to give her credit for the run that she tried to put down. A technically very sophisticated run.
Yeah. Okay, and then coming up, you're calling it Super Thursday.
Yeah, we decided to call this Super Thursday mainly because a lot of schedules have changed and put quite a few events on the same day. We have five medal events in skiing and snowboarding on Thursday. Three of them we have significant medal opportunities. The day is going to kick off with the women's big air, first time ever in the Olympics. We have three athletes in that, so Jamie Anderson, one of the favorites there, along with Julia Marino, also will be among the favorites, and so will be Jessica Jensen for the USA. And that's going to go off first thing in the morning, 9:30 Korean time. And then we're going to head on over to two different venues, Phoenix Park with the men's halfpipe, and that's kicking off at 11:30 local time here, men's halfpipe skiing, and that will be an amazing group there. Alex Ferreira, Torin Yeader Wallace, some great stars in there, and we expect that we could have multiple medals. David Wise, the defending gold medalist, Aaron Blanc as well, all four of our athletes in that. And then down at Jungsion, we'll have the combined downhill. Michaela Schifrin, one of the favorites in that event, and they'll have the slalom coming up at, I think it's at 3:30 in the afternoon. Also mixed in there, we have the men's slalom, the final individual alpine event for the men, and we also have the Nordic combined team event coming up later in the day. So a lot of action, and that kind of leads us into what I'm kind of calling Free Friday. We've got Super Thursday and Free Friday. No events on Friday right now, so a lot of us are going to use the opportunity to maybe go skiing or get down to the coast and, you know, just kind of experience a few of those last-minute Olympic things. And then we come back on the weekend. Saturday's going to be an interesting day. We have the first-ever alpine team event in the Olympics. We have the men's 50K, and we have the men's big air finals in snowboarding. So big Saturday coming up, and then on Sunday, one last event, women's 30K in the closing ceremony to wrap up what has been a very successful Olympic Games here in Pyeongchang.
Okay, Tom, we'll get a final recap from you on Monday, right?
Yep, sounds good. And I'll give you a report on Friday, and then I will be back in studio Monday morning.
Okay, great. Hey, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Leslie.
It's Tom Kelly, Vice President of Communications for U.S. Ski and Snowboard. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the new snow, a welcome relief to everyone, especially those at Soldier Hollow who will be hosting the country's premier junior cross-country athletes at next month's Junior National Championships. In the studio, I have the venue's cross-country programs manager, Sarah Studebaker-Hall. Good morning to you, Sarah.
Good morning.
So let's start with the good news, snow. Did you guys get enough there to open more than the 2.5K ribbon that you had earlier?
Yeah, the snow's been really great. We have been able to open some more trails. Also, the cold temperatures are really helping our snowmaking. We've been able to make snow, which isn't always a guarantee this time of year.
Right. So will that carry things through Junior Nationals then?
Yeah, the Junior Nationals are looking really good. You know, a couple weeks ago, I think it was a little scary for all of us over there. But, you know, now with the new snow and the cold temperatures, we're feeling really, really good about hosting the country to come and do some great racing here in a couple weeks.
Yeah. How much trail do you have, actually? I mean, if everything was open.
If everything's open, I believe we have about, like, between 15 and 20 kilometers, depending on exactly what they can open.
Yeah, so what are you hoping to get open then?
So, you know, originally our goal was to have a really solid 2.5 kilometers. That's pretty much the minimum that you need to be able to hold a really good race. Now I think it's looking a little bit better that we should be able to have between 3 and 5 kilometers open for racing on.
Okay. So Junior Nationals will be held starting when?
The first race is March 6th. It goes that whole week. So March 6th through 10th, there's 4 races.
Okay. And what races are we holding?
So there's a couple of individual races. There's a classic individual race and a skate individual race, as well as a relay and a sprint race.
Okay. No biathlon?
No biathlon yet. Yeah, our big biathlon races are at the end of March, hopefully. So that'll be another good thing that's coming out of this snow, is hopefully we can hold on to snow a little bit longer than we have in the past and be able to host the U.S. National Championships for biathlon.
Okay. How many kids do you actually have competing at these Junior Nationals? I know I went out one year and it was like, there are a lot of kids.
Yeah, there's, I think, over 300 kids from around the country that come to these races that qualify. Locally, from Team Soldier Hollow, we have 3 kids that have qualified this year. Park City Nordic has several kids that have qualified, as well as the Wasatch Nordic team has, I think, you know, 6 or 7 kids that have qualified as well.
Okay, so we got a good local showing.
Yeah, and it should be really great for them. You know, it's not often that you get to race really huge events on your home soil, so should be good advantage for all of those kids.
Yeah, now are they either classical or skate, or do they do both?
No, all the kids do both. So, you know, the goal with Junior Nordic Racing is to get kids experience, so they'll race distance races, they'll race sprint racing. You know, in the Olympics, you see people who only do sprint racing, or they only do classic or something. But at the junior level, we encourage kids to learn and do all of those events.
Yeah, and after yesterday's results with cross country, I'm sure we've inspired a lot of kids.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember growing up being a Nordic athlete, we were really excited if someone made it in the top 30. And now, you know, to have an Olympic gold medal is it's huge. It's huge for our sport, for sure.
Yeah. So what kind of preparations do you need to get ready? I guess you needed the snow, and now that we've got that.
Yeah, you know, the venue that we have is great at these kind of events. You know, last year we hosted U.S. Nationals for Nordic skiing and World Juniors. And so Junior Nationals is pretty similar event. Our staff is great. We have a great group of volunteers. They kind of have been running on what they've known for a while now. So this is a, you know, I wouldn't say it's an easy event for us to put on, but with the snow, it definitely makes it a lot less challenging.
Yeah. And then where do all the kids stay? Just at local hotels and stuff?
Yeah. So the kids come as groups of teams. So our region is the Intermountain region. So the kids qualify within that region, and then the region comes as a group and stays together. So the Intermountain, for example, is staying at the Zermatt. A lot of other teams are staying there as well. Homestead, I believe, is hosting a bunch of people, as well as other hotels, depending on the size of the region.
All right. And do they come a little bit earlier to start training? Or?
Yeah, I think most teams will come over the weekend.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the new biathlon program, because you've just formed that. How many kids you have participating in that?
Yeah, so we have a couple of different programs with biathlon right now. We have our Team Soldier Hollow kids who do biathlon. We have about 15 of those kids, plus another 5 to 10 kids coming from Park City or the Utah Nordic Alliance team. So we have, I would say, probably 20 to 25 kids doing biathlon on a regular basis. But yeah, it's the first time, I think, maybe since the games that range has been being used on a regular basis, and especially for youth athletes. So getting a lot of young people involved and learning the sport.
What's the minimum age then for somebody to participate, given that, I mean, you've got an air rifle, but it's still a rifle?
Yeah, so we start kids as young as 10. You know, it depends a little bit. Well, you know, if there's a 9-year-old who's pretty mature and precocious and really excited about it, then we might, you know, let them in. But mostly 10 is kind of our youngest age. And we start them at 10 with right away with the 22 rifles. We have a system that allows the rifles to be kind of locked down to the firing line, so they're much safer. And we also, you know, we hammer in the safety aspect of the sport and making sure that that's the priority when they're first learning.
All right. And then we've got a World Cup biathlon scheduled. For when's that?
Yeah. So next February, so February of 2019, there's a World Cup. I believe it's the 10th through the 17th, or Those dates could be a little bit wrong, but middle of the month of February. It's pretty exciting. This is the first World Cup that we'll have been here since before the Olympics. We're here in 2002, and it should be a great, great event. So the athletes will be coming from Canmore. So the International Biathlon Union tries to pair up events that are close by, and so they'll come from Canmore down to here and do three or four races here, and we'll get to see the best in the world compete. It'll be pretty exciting.
Okay. So again, you guys are open with a little bit more than 2.5Ks now.
Yeah. We have some really great skiing, and you can find more information on our website at soldierhollow.com.
Okay. Sarah, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.